Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Body Serve. I'm Jonathan.
And I'm James.
This is episode 114 and a detour from our regular tennis scheduling.
Yeah, this is the first totally non-tennis episode we've had in quite a long time, probably over a year.
We've been promising it for a long time, and I've had to deal with your bitching and complaining, yeah, frankly.
Because you've had to put it off many times.
I don't make the tennis calendar.
And the problem is that it doesn't stop.
And the tennis calendar, or yeah, my bit,
well,
or your bitching.
Of course, it's bad for the players, but it's even worse for us, I would argue.
We're figuring out how we're going to release episodes, and like sometimes it just doesn't work out. It hasn't worked out for a while. Like, we need a break sometimes from tennis. That's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it just so happens that the Oscars happened last night, and so this episode, which we've had the agenda planned for a long time to be mostly TV, kind of dovetails with this mini gap before Indian Wells starts.
So I think it was actually a wonderful year for movies, unexpectedly. I said that I wasn't going to watch the Oscars because I was getting really upset about the predictability of the major awards, that I felt Three Billboards was going to win Best Picture. I was just over it. But I found myself, like every good gay, drawn back in again.
It is, as they say, the Super Bowl for us gays.
It sure is. I've been watching the Oscars for as long as I can remember, since I was a little kid with my mom. I'd have to go to bed before the big awards, which was always depressing. Sometimes I would tape it and purposely not find out, not look at anything, until I got home so I could watch it.
Oh, the 90s and early 2000s.
Can you even imagine, young people, can you imagine a time when you could actually avoid the news?
You mean somebody didn't call you up on the landline and spoil it for you?
I did not have a rotary phone, but yes, we did have a landline on the wall. Nobody spoiled it. My friends were really, really well behaved.
A disclaimer here before we get into this discussion. We're going to be talking about three films in particular: Call Me By Your Name, The Shape of Water, and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. The disclaimer being that we really liked two and really hated one.
Can you guess?
Let me take you through my experience with Three Billboards. I was on my break from work. I was in the car and I watched the trailer. And it was one of the most exciting, funny trailers I'd seen in quite some time. I watched that trailer and I immediately texted you. I was like, we have to see this. Mm. This looks amazing. And then we watch it, and halfway through, we're both kind of looking at each other. And then by the end of it, we're like, wow, that was really bad.
I wanted to like it so much. And we saw it before a lot of the backlash started. I had heard a few things about weirdness, a few scenes that people found either racist or problematic because of the way it used racial slurs or whatever. But we didn't really see like the sweeping reviews about it yet. And
which is to say our response is not influenced by other people. Well, we got to this film pretty early on. It's one of the ones that we watched earliest.
I just want to say, though, like, it's possible to dislike this movie just because you dislike it. I don't like the whole, oh, people just hate it because it was leading the Oscar Best Picture race, or because they think they sound more woke if they dislike it. I just simply did not like it. It was like Three Billboards Outside Any Town USA. The Still Processing podcast with the New York Times did a great piece about the sort of lack of place in this movie. It was set in a fictional town of Missouri, and it felt very, very fictional. To me, the characters were cartoonish. The place looked like an old Wild West movie set. It just, nothing really rang true for me.
And for me, I did take exception to its treatment of race. And while I do get that this is a fictional piece, it felt like at every turn, the black characters, the treatment of the black characters was not even secondary, but tertiary.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was firmly entrenched in the background playing second fiddle to whatever the hell these white characters want to do.
I mean, okay, Frances McDormand was basically the town's domestic terrorist. She burned down the police station, and her black friend, went to jail for it.
Can we talk about that?
And her black friend left a post-it for her saying, "Hi, I'm in jail. Okay, thanks, bye. BRB." Like, I mean, what?
Like, she gets sent to jail because of Francis, right?
Yeah.
And we don't see Francis go visit her. We don't see any of that happen behind the scenes. And then the next time we see this woman, she's showing up to the billboard like, "Hey, girl, I'm out of prison. Ain't nothing."
Oh, did I tell you? I was in jail for quite a while. For half this movie.
You know, I may have been abused by some of those racist cops that y'all have been talking about this whole film.
It was so, like, when they mentioned the abuse of the town's black citizens by the cops, it was so blasé, like, it was so flippant that I couldn't really take it seriously. It sounded like a joke.
There's also been a lot of talk about the policeman played by Sam Rockwell, right? And the exception that a lot of folks take to his character is that he's painted in a redemptive light toward the end. And while I don't disagree with that, what I do disagree with is the folks who want to dismiss that, given everything else that we've seen in the film about how the black characters are treated and how they're talked about.
Mm. I think, like, the redemptive arc doesn't have to, on its face, be problematic.
No.
I do take issue with that a little bit. My problem with the movie is that I didn't find the characters believable. I didn't understand their motivations. I felt that it was kind of an approximation of regular folks. It was like Hollywood people trying to write a film about regular people having never met regular people. And while I don't think that's necessarily the case, it felt that way. I didn't get it. And I wanted so, so much to like it because I love Frances McDormand as an actress. I think Sam Rockwell is a really great actor. And Martin McDonagh directed In Bruges, which is probably one of my favorite movies of the past 10 years.
It failed in creating some kind of emotional attachment to these characters. I think that's one of the biggest failings of the film. And perhaps that was by design, but you have Frances McDormand who we get a flashback where she's arguing with her daughter and that's the last time she sees her. And then we know that she's then raped and killed.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't feel particularly moved by that scene. I don't feel particularly moved by Woody Harrelson's spoiler who kills himself. And he's supposed to be one of the kind of good guys in the movie. But again, I just don't care.
I wonder, like, in 10 years, if I go back and watch it, I'll see something different. Like, will I get it? Or was it just bad?
That's also a possibility, you know, that we just don't get it.
It's a distinct possibility. I'm not so arrogant to believe that our opinion is the only right opinion.
No.
You know? Because there are a lot of talented people that came together to make this film. I don't get it. And while I love Frances McDormand, I hated this performance. And I know a lot of people are saying, oh, the performances were great, but the movie was bad. I actually really didn't like the lead performance at all. I didn't like the words that were coming out of her mouth. Everything was caustic. Like, everything was at 10. And I needed it to be brought down a little bit.
So you're saying there wasn't much nuance? You needed a little bit of
there
nuance.
There was zero nuance. And that is probably an artistic choice. That's probably a purposeful choice that I just did not get.
Part of the reason why I didn't get it. We're opening up the possibility of it just not being for us and that we just don't get it, is that this film comes out in this climate in America. I can't separate myself from that as well. You know, when there are black men being murdered wantonly by police in America, a glib passing comment about, or a joke about the racist cop and how he treats the black townspeople doesn't fly with me. And this is not an indictment of the people who do like it. You know, art is, you're meant to be able to escape into art. And if you're able to do that, good for you. I think that was one of the reasons why I wasn't able to.
I think it speaks to social media and, like, woke Twitter in a certain way because it comes on the heels of the New York Times editorial department and really the news department seeking myriad ways to humanize racists, regular folks. It's always like, we need to understand the Trump voter. And the New York Times has been the number one contributor to this genre. So I think you can see this movie as, let's understand white trash, for lack of a better word. I don't say that disparagingly, but I think a lot of people in Hollywood see the flyover states and they're like, I wonder what those people think and feel. Let's dive into that in the most simplistic way possible.
And in reality, we are in a very special period where minority voices are being heard and their stories are being told. And that's something that we'll get into a little bit later on with respect to the huge success of Black Panther, Moonlight last year, Get Out this year, and then a myriad TV shows where, whether it's all black casts or different aspects of black life in America are being told, that is far more interesting to me than a retreading of, how do I say this, of this story again in this kind of wanton, haphazard, let's throw everything on the wall and see what sticks for comedy sakes. I didn't get it.
Like, specificity is important because it can make things feel universal. A really dialed in, localized, specific story can make you feel something because it feels real. So don't set it in what looks like the Warner Brothers lot of a John Wayne movie. Like, set it in a real city with characters who feel like humans.
A very specific example of what you're talking about and how that works brilliantly is Godless. That was one of the shows that utilized that the best this year.
I agree. It was a Netflix, seven-parter? It was a Western that was meant to foreground female characters. And to varying success. You know, there was a lot of maleness still. But it's a fascinating story, acted well, photographed beautifully. And it felt very, what's the word? Like, it felt really specific.
Anyway, so we were happy that Three Billboards didn't win. Mm-hmm. And the winner of the Oscar for Best Picture was The Shape of Water, which I tweeted last night. This was absolutely a film that, had I seen it in my 20s, I would have not been here for it. I needed to be in my 30s to enjoy this movie.
Well, spoiler alert, she did fuck that fish, if that's what you were thinking.
Well,
To be crude.
The very first time we saw that trailer, I turned to you and I said, she really did. She's going to fuck the fish, isn't she?
No, but jokes aside, the film was gorgeously rendered. Sally Hawkins is a favorite of mine. She plays a woman who can't speak. Richard Jenkins, Octavia Spencer, who is basically great in just about anything I've seen, regardless of the quality of the material.
Michael Shannon is there playing the evil guy again.
Mm-hmm. Who is terrifying. And Michael Stuhlbarg, who could have won an Oscar for this film or Call Me By Your Name. Like, take your pick. He's excellent in both. The movie embraces magical realism, which I absolutely love in fiction and in novels. And I just felt like everything came together. The music was whimsical, was evocative.
You had a musical toward the end, just out of nowhere.
Right.
Where she's dancing Fred Astaire with the fish.
With the fish man.
And it just came out of nowhere, and you're like, okay, this is happening. I'm here for it.
It was just a simple, basically a romance about loneliness. And what people do, how they seek ways to remedy their loneliness. It was sad. It was incredibly sad, but also moving.
It was also about communication. And what Sally Hawkins was able to do with so few words in this film is really one of the untold stories of this award season. When was the last time you saw somebody say so little in a film?
Yeah. If you haven't seen Sally Hawkins in Happy Go Lucky or Made in Dagenham, definitely go see those. Or rent them. How do you rent movies these days? Stream them?
You can you rent on iTunes? I know you can buy them on iTunes.
I think.
You must be able to. I think you do so. Rent it. And they give it to you for like 3 days or something. man, Blockbuster. Do you remember renting films from Netflix and have them come in the mail?
Oh, the DVD delivery, that was the best.
That was one of the best parts of college.
Because you get like everything. Mm-hmm. Because now the selection is terrible.
The film that we want to talk about most is Call Me By Your Name. And last night after the show, I was thinking how amazing it would have been in my teen years to have been able to live through Moonlight winning Best Picture last year, and then Call Me By Your Name getting such great press and publicity and visibility throughout this entire award season. There's a lot to be said about the fact that neither of the main characters is gay. There are critiques to be made about this film.
In Moonlight?
No, in Call Me By Your Name.
Oh.
I guess the same could be said about Moonlight as well. It's a recurring, quote-unquote, problem in mainstream gay films.
Or they don't identify as gay. Is that what you mean?
The actors themselves?
No, the characters.
No. I'm talking about the actors.
Oh.
Like the strict visibility of gay people playing gay roles.
Right.
You know, like there's a lot of flaws to still pick apart.
Mm.
But the meta takeaway is that this is still such a great thing. Like that's the thing that I hang my hat on in spite of all the flaws, which we will get to in a little bit.
Mm.
And subsequent to that, building off of that, I hesitate to say how lucky the young gays have it now. But instead, I will say the future just looks that much brighter for them. And this is what progress is. This is what the struggle is for. You know, those who have come before struggle so that the younger kids can enjoy these moments and not have to suffer the way that others did before them.
Right. Like, you shouldn't have to suffer. It should be easy for you.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we want it to be. People before us, long before us, suffered so we didn't have to.
And there's an emotion that we have, and we've talked about it before, where we see kids, gay kids these days, take certain things for granted, and we're like, these ungrateful, unlearned wretches.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's a feeling and a sentiment that we have to kind of fight against.
Right.
Right? Because it's not fair to them.
Well,
but they still need to learn their history.
They do. And I should say, I should correct myself, that previous generations of gay and queer people didn't suffer necessarily for us. They suffered, period. And they fought for their lives.
There was nothing but suffering.
Right. Well, and the byproduct in many ways was that we can live a much easier life than they did. And they didn't necessarily do that for us. They did that because they had to. So that's really what I meant. So this movie, Call Me By Your Name, was notable to me because of the lack of suffering, the lack of trauma. It's rare that we see high-profile gay movies that aren't about coming out, AIDS, violence, suffering, pain, centered around identity.
Family
and
conflict.
Shame, right? It was set in almost this fantastical place. In northern Italy in the early 80s, the family was privileged. They lived in this amazing villa. They have a grad student visiting all summer. And it's really about an idle, warm, repetitive, monotonous summer in this gorgeous landscape. It doesn't feel like real life.
Love story between the two main characters and the setting as well.
Right.
When that film started and they tell you, it comes up on screen, what year this film is set in, my immediate thought is, oh my God, AIDS.
Of course.
You know, like it's a thing that colors my perspective immediately. And I went into it, neither of us had read the book. Neither of us really knew a whole lot about the story. So when that's one of the very first things that we see, we're immediately on the lookout. We don't know that there's not going to be that kind of drama and trauma coming.
Right.
Right. But it's a thing that gives context to everything else that comes for us.
So having watched the movie for the first time, I left feeling exhilarated that there was a movie about queer romance, about lust and love and the beginnings of a relationship that so many of us were not able to experience. Especially at Elio's age, at 17. those things were just not available to a lot of us. And I actually appreciated that we got a queer film that wasn't centered in trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I think about it further, I'm thinking, what else was going on in the world in the early 80s? Like you said, AIDS is sort of a specter that haunts the edges of this movie. The fact that there's a lot of spoilers here, by the way, so just be prepared. The fact that Oliver leaves, doesn't come back, and reveals that he's going to get married at the end of the film is devastating. It can be read as pain that is not specifically gay pain, but we see it as this is a homophobic society. He's doing what's expected of him because of his station in life, because of his parents, who knows? So all of these sort of outside influences still find a way to weasel themselves into the story, but it's not it's not part of the text. It's part of the context.
Mm-hmm. And Oliver leaves. They break up, in effect, and then we find out that Oliver is getting married to a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the first thoughts I had was, well, you know, maybe they'll get back to each other later in life somehow.
Right.
But who is to say either of them would have been alive by 1992?
God, that hits really hard. So in some ways, I do wonder, given the loaded subject matter, did the movie kind of take the easy way out by not engaging with these issues, by being totally depoliticized? Or are we supposed to read the subtext?
Maybe we're supposed to read the text, because we haven't read the book.
Right. But this is a film that's supposed to stand on its own as a text. The movie is a text in and of itself.
I enjoyed the whimsy and the fancifulness and the beauty of it. So much of the stories that have been told historically about gay people have been fraught with suffering.
Mm-hmm.
There is a lot of suffering in our history. And this film succeeded in delivering emotional heft without having to go to those wells.
Right. Because toward the end, we're coming toward the end of a relationship, the end of someone's first love, this feeling of loss that almost everyone can relate to, knowing that you may never see this person again. And if you do, it'll never be in the same way. Like, that tore me up. But it wasn't specifically queer. It's something that felt universal. And like I said earlier, specificity can feel universal in this way, because although you may not relate to these characters on paper, there's something about that, like, sucking sense of loss that is, I think, speaks to many, many people.
Can you recall a film that ended with such gut-wrenching, soul-crushing grief in recent times?
Well, okay.
I mean,
it's the final few scenes that really just kicked your ass. It was Michael Stuhlbarg's monologue to his son, accepting him, begging him to indulge in the pain of losing a relationship, not sublimate these emotions. And then you have Elio crying in front of the fire for 5 minutes while the credits roll. And it was like perfectly teenager too. It was sad. Like, it's sad, but it's also, wow, teenagers are really dramatic. You know? And I love that. I love that they let Elio be a kid in that way.
Let's talk about some of the flaws of the film. Because while we loved it, there were some things that we didn't quite enjoy. One being, for me, I felt that while the love story was great, the casting of Armie Hammer was not.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Timothée Chalamet gave an incredible performance. I thought it was very complicated and appealing, and I just absolutely loved him in this part. Armie Hammer was good, but I don't feel that he rose to the same level. And also, he's way too old. He just looks too old.
For me, it was the physicality of the two of them. Mm. I felt he looked too big and too old.
Yeah, like, he's supposed to be 24. Elio is
17.
There's
no way he's 24 looking in that film.
No.
And he's towering over him in stature and musculature. It's a not to be a prude about it, but it did give some pause to the whole age gap.
Mm-hmm. And you know that straight people, especially straight men, are made uncomfortable by this.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause, well, they probably see their sons, right?
Well, this was something I thought about. I'm like, oh my God, like the backlash that's coming from this.
Right. This is not two grown cowboys in Wyoming screwing in a tent.
Mm-hmm. When in fact, Elio is 17 and he's under his parents' roof and he has their permission.
Right.
So, like, this is not... And he's consenting. So what we're made to deal with is our own feelings that we've been taught to think and feel about this kind of scenario.
Mm.
And how much of that is... can exist outside of the Me Too movement that's happening right now. Again, talking about context with these films. And how much of that is our own prejudices and biases.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people watching this movie don't know the history of gay communities where those relationships are actually very, very common. And the age gap is often much bigger than that.
Mm-hmm.
Many famous gay men had much younger partners. At one point, alarmingly younger.
And especially in that time and in the decades preceding that, those relationships were often the first safe space that these young gay men find themselves in where they can explore themselves, because they don't get that from their family. They can't get into bars. It's unconventional, but it's their introduction into gay life. And when there is no quote-unquote normal template for you to be able to explore your sexuality, like, you find whatever ways are available to you.
Right. And it can certainly be exploitative. And I think the movie leaves that possibility open, honestly. Although the parents have blessed the relationship, I still think the problems are sort of haunting the edges.
And we're made to feel better about that because of how precocious Elio is and how smart he is.
Mm.
And so we're not meant to think of them as intellectually unequal. Something I also struggled with the film, and I'm hesitant to say that this is because of Armie's performance. Again, I haven't read the book. But sitting there and watching it, I'm thinking, where is this going? Like, we know without question that Elio is into Oliver very early on. And we know that at some point something's going to happen because we know this is a gay romance film, right? Mm. But it seemed to go from Oliver just being kind of a dick to in love with him in the span of right. 2 minutes. Like, it felt a little bit abrupt to me in terms of him switching over.
Well, I think you're meant to think that he was fighting this feeling for a long time. And I didn't see the fight. And part of that is because it was really in Elio's perspective, the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't. Like, the tension for me wasn't there until it was there.
When Elio confronts him and says, you know, I didn't really know, you know, he says, well, what do you think that back rub was? I'm like, is that what we're right. supposed to take from that?
I mean, straight men touch each other all the time. Like, I don't get these things.
Anything else you want to say about the film?
Just one more thing about this and other movies like Moonlight. I wonder, there's been sort of this trend of major queer films with characters who don't necessarily identify as queer or gay. And I wonder how much of that is organic and how much of it is like, this story is going to sell with woke straight people really well. I think movies like this and Moonlight have a really strong artistic voice. I wonder how the film is decoded by straight people. Are we more authentic, more relatable when we don't identify strongly with a specific group? Is identity politics seen as passé or kind of low art, I wonder?
It brings to mind what Kumail Nanjiani said last night in the telecast. There was some kind of a montage sequence that was going on.
Mm.
And he said, you know, I've sat through all these films told from the straight white male perspective, and I was able to relate to it. Now, you watch my perspective and you relate to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, this is, which is to say, he'd been having to find himself in these films in whatever way he could, even though it wasn't written for him all these years. And so the rub there is that when films aren't necessarily made for you, you should still have the intellectual curiosity to find what it's about and to find ways to relate to it as well. Your perspective and your view of the world is not the be-all end-all. Am I reading that right?
Yes, but how are you relating it to what I said?
I guess it's kind of railing against what you said.
Oh, okay.
In that I don't really... I find it a flaw in this storytelling. Like, yes, there's a... By the same token that there's the universality of the story, of specificity, of that coming of age, young first love, being relatable. The fact that the characters don't necessarily identify as gay shouldn't be the one thing to then make it accessible for you. You know, like, how simplistic are people?
Oh, right. No, I'm saying, like, if these characters openly picked a side, is that seen as less artistic, less prestigious? It seems like this kind of mystery, like this muddying of identity, makes a film seem more sophisticated.
Oh, see, I was reading it as you wondering if it made it more universal.
No. No, okay. I'm wondering if it makes it easier to market to straight people who imagine themselves as open-minded and woke.
But if they are open-minded and woke, then this should be right up the alley. Like, it should be like, oh my god, there's an indie gay film. Let's go see that. That's right up my alley.
I guess.
Now let's move into the television part of the episode. And let's talk about a couple trends that we've been seeing in the last couple of years. The first being a question to you: are we finally seeing a shift for good in the types of stories being told on TV and in film, specifically with respect to black art, with Black Panther, Moonlight, Get Out, and then on TV with Dear White People, Atlanta, Insecure, She's Gotta Have It, Blackish, Queen Sugar, Greenleaf, The Chi,
right,
and probably a few others that I'm leaving out?
Well, I'm probably not the best position to answer this question, but yeah, I think this is a particularly fertile period in movies and television, especially, as you say, for the black experience in the US. I mean, people have been doing brilliant work for as long as these media have existed, really. But it seems like executives are finally spending money where they should be. You mentioned Get Out, like, which was just a surprising award season contender, a huge box office success. Black Panther is on its way to becoming one of the biggest box office films in American history. Get Out, for what it's worth, was my favorite movie of the year. It was the best theater experience I've ever had. It was nerve-wracking, interactive. It was uncomfortable when you looked around the theater and saw who was there. I mean, the movie was just unexpected in so many ways.
I think the main culprit is not the right word, but the reason why this is happening is because there's so many new ways in which TV is being produced now. Netflix has a few of these shows. Kudos to FX that's creating a show like Atlanta. And then HBO took Issa Rae on board.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, yes, risks are being taken in ways that they haven't been done before, but the competition between all these different studios and new ways of TV making has forced executives to make decisions that they haven't made before. And we're getting all this great content from auteurs who haven't had the access before.
Mm-hmm. Look at Ryan Coogler. In just a few years, made A Fruitland Station, Black Panther, Creed, huge money-making movies, has a clear artistic vision. I think a lot of it is, cynically, like, people are going where the money is. Gina Rodriguez was on Marc Maron's podcast the other day and was saying that Latinos per capita are bigger spenders than other major demographic groups. So it's about executives looking at the market research and see who is spending money and where are they spending it. How much money did Bridesmaids make? Girls Trip was a major smash as an R-rated comedy. Like, people are crying out for stories about them and by people who look like them. Like, make them.
And you have this fascinating juxtaposition in a political climate where the GOP is spending all this money to keep minorities away from the polls and keep them out of the process. Whereas these studio people are, again, you say cynically, but they're including them.
Mm-hmm. And believe me, it's not because they feel a lot of goodwill or because they have progressive social consciousness. It's because they are figuring out different ways to make money.
But there is progress where somebody like Lena Waithe can script one of the best episodes of TV for the entire year, mm-hmm. and then turn that into one of the most promising careers as an actress and screenwriter now.
And now a showrunner, a creator of The Chi.
Yeah. So in a lot of ways, you have that cynicism, but then you also have Black people and people of color looking out for each other. Oprah is out here making Black content on her own network.
Mm-hmm.
That's by design.
Yeah. And it also helps that it's more acceptable for these major names to pivot to TV now.
Yes.
Dee Reese is directing episodes of Queen Sugar, which is created by Ava DuVernay, who is a major film director. Issa Rae is writing, directing, creating this series.
That is a big shift in and a trend, absolutely, because mm-hmm. Big Little Lies, one of the biggest shows and most acclaimed shows of the last year, starred Reese Witherspoon, Nicole Kidman, Laura Dern, all these huge right. movie actresses who then go to HBO to go make a television series. The other trend that I've noticed is, and this one absolutely, you can fall one way or the other on that fence, is this trend of old shows being brought back.
Uh-huh. I feel like you can think the trend is kind of lame, but still think that there's good work happening in those series.
The list, I mean, this is maybe a half of what's actually happening that I have here.
Yeah. I'm looking at your list. Roswell? What?
Yeah.
Like the WB show?
Mm-hmm. Will and Grace, Roseanne, Fuller House, Charmed.
Charmed.
Yeah.
Charmed. Is Shannen Doherty coming back?
I haven't looked into it. Dynasty, Miami Vice. Really, who's asking for Miami Vice?
Wait, I feel like Miami... Oh, they made a movie again, right?
Yeah, no, it's I believe it's a TV show that's coming back now, too. Murphy Brown, which I am so excited about. Queer Eye, Gilmore Girls, Twin Peaks. Like, this is just two handfuls of the shows that have been brought back. Again, for better or worse.
And like, one day at a time.
Yeah.
Very successfully.
Well, it's because slightly it was different. Reimagined. Yes. It's a bit of a different take on the original. But these stories are being rehashed, for better or worse.
In most cases, worse. I mean, like, Will and Grace has been a very successful comeback. And I was surprised. It took a few episodes to get off the ground. And it's still, like, it's corny, right? And even in the last few years of Will and Grace, in its original run, it was very corny. And it was bogged down by a lot of stunt casting, Madonna, Britney Spears. There was like a celebrity in every episode toward the end. But they do recapture that magic sometimes. And it's worth watching for those reasons.
And it's also a reminder that the best bits of that show have very little to do with Will and Grace.
Well, yeah. Everybody knows that.
But why is this happening?
Well, I think that our generation is really indulgent in nostalgia. That's good. You can look on BuzzFeed every single day about, do you feel old yet? Here are all the things you grew up with in the 90s and 2000s. They don't contribute anything culturally. It's literally just a retread of things you grew up with. But like, that's it. That's why a lot of these things are not very interesting, because it's trying to recapture this magic, make you feel something in the way that you did when you were a kid.
Some of the more successful new shows are successful because of that as well. Stranger Things, it plays off of 80s nostalgia exclusively.
Right. And nostalgia is not new. Like, American Graffiti in 1973 practically invented nostalgia for the 1950s. It's just got... I mean, there's nothing new under the sun, right? It makes you feel something that you can't put your finger on. That is, at the same time, painful and euphoric.
If we accept that nostalgia has always been a part of the television experience, does it make sense that so many of these shows are from the late 80s and 90s?
Well, because look who's producing television now. They finally have a seat at the table. People our age and younger, right?
Mad Men being produced is not nearly as much about the nostalgia because of the distance between that era as it is for Murphy Brown coming back. Like, it's new ground in that these stories are still so close in our rearview mirror. And that's, I guess, why so many of us are skeptical about it. Like, why are we telling these stories again? Weren't they just here?
Mm.
Whereas you feel like something like Mad Men can be told in a new way. It's introducing something to a new generation. Those people, a lot of the fans of Mad Men didn't live through that. It's getting a window into a very peculiar and unfamiliar time. Something that you've only read about.
Yeah. Even like our parents were babies during that era. But something like, well, Will and Grace, you said Murphy Brown, they can show how much our culture has changed just in the past 20, 25 years. It's profound. Like, Will and Grace has had to reorient its politics and its cultural outlook because so many of the jokes they made back then would be unacceptable now.
They'd be totally offensive.
Yeah, well, then there are some that have lingered that are still very offensive and racist.
I think something that's very telling about how we view older people and the demographics of that we make television for is the fact that the Golden Girls hasn't been remade. I mean, there's Grace and Frankie, which is like the closest thing to that. You have a show with 70-somethings and Jane Fonda is now 80. You know, that's the only show I can think of where you have septuagenarians on TV. Like, the beauty of the Golden Girls in the 80s and into the 90s was that this was absolutely a demographic that was not represented on TV. And one would have thought that would have opened up avenues for similar stories to be told. Like, what are these networks doing? Like, fine. Like, your 75-year-old grandmother is not necessarily at home with a Netflix subscription. So maybe Netflix won't do it.
You know, but mine is.
But NBC, hello. Like, these are some of the few people who still hold on to cable subscriptions, and you're not creating content for them.
Mm.
And The Golden Girls was such a brilliant template of how that can be brilliant.
Because it treated older people like they were human, like they had
active sex lives.
Right. That they had desires like the rest of us. Because so many people don't think of their grandparents as fully three-dimensional human beings with desires and heartache and all these things,
instead,
right?
Instead, you have a retread. You said retread before.
What is...
I think it's retread.
Oh, Lord.
Maybe you can tell us which is
right. Go back right and believe that.
Instead, we have like a retread of the same actresses who get maybe one or two episodes where they impart some wisdom and then they die.
Mm-hmm. June Squibb is a good example of that. She plays the wise old lady in a lot of things, or sassy old lady.
But the story isn't about them. They're just there on the fringes. And then eventually their death is used to cause conflict for the main characters.
Oh, Lord.
Mm-hmm. And what the Golden Girls showed is that there's so much more to life than that. People are living longer. They're living more fruitful lives. Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin are out here on Netflix selling vibrators.
I wonder, you know, you said something about how we have to recognize that these stories should be told, that there's gaps in the market. Like, people probably said that when Diane Carroll had her own show on network TV, mm-hmm. when Sanford and Son and the Jeffersons were on in the late 70s, saying, wow, finally, these stories are being told. And then what? And then nothing. Right? Like, long periods of just desert.
Is this
a sea change?
Gina Davis talked about this last night, mm-hmm. saying that everybody was talking about how when Thelma and Louise came out, that this was going to be a game changer. We're going to have more films with female leads and not have to rely on the straight white male protagonist.
Mm-hmm. And it just wasn't.
It didn't.
It wasn't a sea change.
Instead, we've segued into the comic book era. Thankfully, Black Panther is here and Wonder Woman to kind of shake that up a little bit. But then toward the end of the 90s, it segued into prestige television that was the sole domain of these straight white men doing awful shit.
Yeah.
Sopranos.
The white anti-hero. Mm-hmm. And Don Draper was kind of the last. Well, and what's his face?
Walter White.
Walter White was like the last of the anti-heroes. So now you have like prestige TV 2.0, which is Netflix, cable, Jane the Virgin, Godless.
Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Right.
And this is where the various new media have kind of forced the hand. But still, to my point, we're missing, outside of Grace and Frankie, old folks mm-hmm. getting their due. So that's what I'm looking forward to. I want to see, with this trend of remakes, I want to see a Golden Girls remake.
No.
I absolutely do.
No. Let's see.
It can be a reimagining. It doesn't have to be, obviously not going to remake it. Three of the four Golden Girls have died. Yeah. Most of the cast, the recurring characters, are no longer with us. But we can do something similar.
Let's just have shows about old people having fun. I'll watch it.
Sure.
You know what I would watch? A show about old nuns.
Oh my God.
Why has that not happened yet?
The Grand Lady's Tale. We'll finish up with some of our favorite shows of the year. Maybe some of our favorite episodes of the year. And then we'll talk about or mention a few of the shows that we think are the most overrated and then underrated.
Can we talk about The Good Place?
Sure.
I resisted this for so long. A friend of ours said, you have to watch the show. And I love Mike Schur. I love the whole Parks and Recreation universe. The whole ethos. It was like, ugh. A show about the afterlife sounds very depressing and existentially troubling. How is it going
to
be funny?
When it was explained to us what the show was about, we were both there and present. We were both like, ah.
And like, that sounds horrible. But how is the show so good? Why is it so good?
Part of the reason why it's so good is Ted Danson. Mm-hmm. He is one of the absolute best things on TV.
I mean, he's one of the greats in TV history. Sam Malone from Cheers. There's just something about him that is reassuring, that you believe him before and after the big twist at the end of season one.
The big twist, I kept hearing about it, was in fact a big twist. And many lesser shows would not have been able to come back from that in a second season. Mm. And they've managed to do it.
I know you haven't always been the biggest Kristen Bell fan, but I think this show doesn't work without her. Playing against type, playing self-centered, rude, crude, but ultimately very wise. Mm-hmm. I absolutely adore her performance on the show, and I don't think the show would be anywhere without it.
I would agree with that. Mm. The part, I know you hate that I think this, but it's not a weak link, but the character that I really just do not like is Chidi. I cannot deal with Chidi.
Chidi is the greatest. He's always so
indecisive. That kind of indecision in one's life is crippling to live with. It must be crippling for Chidi, but
imagine having to live with him.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's funny. No, because you don't have to live with him.
I just can't.
I just don't get how a show that's really about moral philosophy and ethics is interesting at all. Like, when I describe it to people, I hear myself and I'm like, wow, this sounds horrible. But you should watch it.
We don't need to tell you at this point that Big Little Lies is worth your time.
Yeah, I watched the finale twice in a row. And I'm probably going to watch it again soon because it was that good.
I've never been a big Nicole Kidman fan, but what she did on that series was astounding. I know you think that Reese Witherspoon was maybe even better, or at the very least just as good. I'm not here to tell you that Reese Witherspoon was not good on that show. She was great. I was just most impressed by Nicole Kidman, coming from where I was coming from with her. And the subtlety and the nuance with which she played that role was a revelation. You were a huge fan of The Leftovers.
Ugh, The Leftovers. Man, that show is depressing. So the creators of Leftovers also worked on Lost, and Lost was kind of savaged by its fans for actually answering the big mysteries around the show, because it turned out that once you found out what everything meant, it wasn't that interesting anymore. So The Leftovers decided to fix that by never revealing the central mystery. How and why 98% of the world population was basically raptured. So in the finale, Nora, who's played by Carrie Coon, who just burns your screen, explains that she went over to the other side. Basically, she died. She was raptured, if you will, and found this alternate universe where all those 98% of people were, and they don't think they're dead. So she told the story, and then she came back, and you don't know whether you're supposed to believe it or not, but it's terribly sad, and I'm just in love with this movie, or this show.
This is absolutely not my usual cup of tea in terms of TV shows, but I still thoroughly enjoyed it. And the thing that I thought that they did so well and what I was most impressed by is their treatment of fantasy scenes, like these alternate universe scenes. Mm-hmm. And I remember the very first one where Justin Theroux went into this alternate universe. When they like semi-die.
Yeah.
And I messaged you overnight and I was like, this is so bizarre. You're going to want to hate it, but it was so riveting. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And that is the strength of the show in my mind. Like to allow you, the viewer, to participate in this willful suspension of disbelief.
Mm-hmm. Like these sideways timelines?
Yes.
Because dream sequences are by and large terrible. Mm-hmm. Like nobody wants to hear about other people's dreams. Do you remember, well, you don't because you didn't watch it. The Sopranos did a whole episode in the final season of this alternate universe Tony Soprano, and it was, oh my God, it was so boring. But for some reason, it works on Leftovers.
The Thanksgiving episode of Master of None, we mentioned it briefly before. It's still with me.
Oh my God.
All these months afterward. Mm. It was so good, and it's even doubly impressive that it's Lena Waithe's own story for the most part. And then you have Miss Angela Bassett playing her mother in the flashback sequences. Can you imagine? You're given this big career chance to tell this story and you get to play opposite Angela Bassett.
Like, this episode was so moving. I like how Aziz Ansari kind of took himself out of it for the most part. He allowed Lena Waithe to center herself in the story, even though it's his show. Angela Bassett's performance was crazy. She is fine. Like, I feel like she's finally starting to be appreciated in the larger culture. But her reaction when Lena Waithe's character told her that she was gay, the first thing she did, they were in public, was look around, look behind her. And I thought, God, that is such a smart performance. That is such a clever move.
Wondering, did anybody hear her?
Exactly.
Because it can still be taken back.
Her daughter's homosexuality is her shame, too. She feels a community looking at her. So I felt in that moment, Angela Bassett made such a clever, subtle choice.
And it's a story that's very specific in that way to the Black community. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, you're out, but the church sisters can't know. You know, like there's...
Right.
It's about containment in a lot of ways at that point. And not mentioning it. And like, is your friend coming over for Thanksgiving dinner? That kind of thing. Mm.
Can we talk about Riverdale?
Yes.
Is this show horrible or is it amazing?
Riverdale is horrible and amazing.
It is so heightened. It's visually very beautiful and a direct ripoff of Twin Peaks.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it is an homage to Twin Peaks. The show is really a pastiche of the comics, first of all,
mm-hmm.
Twin Peaks, and a lot of just cultural references from all over the map.
It also reliably, every week, gives you something to thirst at. Because KJ Apa is out here on this show shirtless in all kinds of scenarios where he needn't be.
Mm-hmm. Wrestling singlet. I mean, they invented a wrestling storyline purely to get these guys in singlets.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not mad about it.
This is about knowing your audience. Like, yes, it might be trash, but we're going to give you what you want. And we're going to give you some highbrow and a lot of very lowbrow. And it's going to come together in a melting pot of being enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so the chief mean girl of Riverdale burned down her family's house, or part of it. And somehow now her mother is a sex worker.
Mm-hmm.
A courtesan. Basically, she has sex for money. It's very strange.
Her daughter told her to go out and get a job.
That's a good point. The mother is really wicked. So I enjoyed the few episodes where Cheryl was openly torturing her.
Well, the mothers, by and large, on this show are all very wicked.
Yeah. There's got to be a academic paper in that, because the mothers are all horrible. Some of them are absent. Now they have this whole Black Lives Matter, Indigenous Lives Matter plot where the white students are actually leading the charge against the entrenched conservative people of color, which is strange. The mayor and the lodges are resisting this cultural movement. I don't know if I want to get into that choice artistically, but it's odd.
This is the type of show where you just have to sit down and, unless they do something really problematic, just let it go.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not a smart show. That's not the type of entertainment
it is. But
is it?
There's, yeah. But I can't decide if it's really smart or not. It just gives you everything. You got teen BDSM. You have horror. You have black comedy.
It does it does do a good job of treating social issues well in spots. Mm-hmm. With respect to sexual assault, that was done fairly well.
Yeah.
Why don't we see more of Kevin? Like, you have this hot gay character and we don't see him. So, like, that's something that I don't quite get. Like, there's so much more.
You don't see him naked?
No, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the fact that the only thing we know about him is that he used to go cruising in the woods. And that the straight women were like, that's so dangerous.
Betty had a real problem with it. Betty, Miss Now I'm a Cam Girl.
Right?
Like, really, Betty?
Betty's the worst.
Really,
I
bitch?
I really hate Betty. I do.
I do like bad Betty.
Mm.
And, I mean, her mom, talk about homages to Twin Peaks, her mom is Shelley from Twin Peaks. Mm-hmm.
The one thing that it did smartly in a kind of a long con for the viewer was the reveal of who the real kingpin was in that Lodge family. That was actually, okay, I see you.
Who, the mom?
Yeah.
The Lodges are very bad people.
They are.
I just can't with them.
It says something about the show that there was absolutely a definite point where you were like, I don't know if I can watch this anymore. And now you're fully on board, full throttle.
I'm back in. The cardinal sin of Riverdale is if it's boring.
Mm-hmm.
If it's boring, that's a problem. Because it's a very not boring show.
Glow? Can we talk about Glow? A 1980s women's wrestling TV show. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, which is actually based on a true story. Mm-hmm. A real cable TV show. I did not want to watch it. I was not into it at all.
Mm-hmm.
But wow, I was really bowled over. I like Alison Brie a lot from Mad Men.
I do not.
I just like, she really digs into this character because she is not likable at all.
She's in the Rory Gilmore universe.
No,
for me.
No. Alison Brie gives off this air of erudition, in my opinion. I think she comes off as really smart and more clever than you. Like she knows something that you don't. And I felt that when she played Trudy on Mad Men, that she was able to observe from on high. I love her as a performer.
Okay. We're allowed to disagree.
The Fosters is ending this year. I'm devastated. That show could go on in perpetuity for me. They bring it to you every ball.
And this season in particular, they are doing the most. If you thought they did things in previous seasons, they're throwing everything at you.
Like, there is not a social and political issue they have not tackled on the show. But they do it... I mean, the one quibble with the show is that it is conflict all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That the characters don't get to relax and have fun very often. But they have tackled so many things in such a sensitive way, in a way that communicates to its teenage audience, that, I mean, it's an important show. It really is.
No wonder Terry Polo is having a nervous breakdown. Like, she has to deal with all these kids doing all kind right? of nonsense all the time.
Like, she didn't have time to deal with her own shit right. because Callie's gotten arrested, almost went to prison how many times?
Mariana is always starting some shit.
Literally the same day that Callie was cleared of criminal charges, she was kidnapped by a sex trafficker. And very shortly after that, she was sheltering a dreamer in a local church.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the same day? I don't know.
In fact, if I am those two moms, I would find it very difficult to get on with my life if I had Brandon Foster as my child. Because he is the absolute worst. If I had to deal with that kind of mopiness, that kind of needing to be the center and fix everything by still making horrible decisions all the time, I might just have to give him up for adoption. Like, I would adopt other kids and give away my actual child.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, the actor does this thing where his inflection in every scene is to be like, yeah, I was talking, and I was like, yeah, so what, you think you're just going to not, you're not going to say anything? It's so infuriating. Everything about that character, I cannot deal with. And now he's trying to save another person. He has to save Grace while she's on her cancer deathbed.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about taking the flaws of a character and turning it up full 100. Right?
Like, man, we've seen Jack Shepard on Lost. We've been through this before.
Let's finish up with some overrated and underrated shows in our humble opinions.
In your opinion. I see a lot of shows I like and you're overrated. I find this troubling.
I didn't really care for Handmaid's Tale. Sorry.
I have a complicated relationship with Handmaid's Tale for several reasons. Do you want to go first?
It's becoming increasingly clear to me that I just don't really care for Elizabeth Moss, and that's a huge part of it. And I cannot separate what I know of her as a Scientologist from her being an actress, and especially on this show, where it's supposedly, allegedly, a feminist piece of work, and she's out here not being able to speak directly to the show's feminism at all.
Yeah, here's where I'm at with Handmaid's Tale. I think the actual text, like what we're given as the series, is beautifully done and in large part extremely well acted. It's filmed in Toronto, mostly in Toronto and other places in Ontario. I think it's a beautifully produced TV show. The context is what is tripping me up. And this is something we are going back to from the beginning part of the episode. I'm annoyed with Margaret Atwood right now. She lives in Toronto, so we get a lot of news about her, just her opinions about everything, basically, because we live here. I absolutely love her as a novelist. I love Handmaid's Tale. I've read it a few times. I'm just like, she's written some things about sort of picking apart the Time's Up movement and talking about due process. And I'm just like, God, you sound old. And I don't mean that, like, that sounds horrible, but, like, you sound like you're picking apart something that's actually doing good work, and it's annoying the hell out of me. I don't like where Margaret Atwood is going right now. And the same thing with Elizabeth Moss. Is she the right messenger for this material? And should that matter? I think that's a genuine question. Does her life, her experience matter at all if the performance is this good? And I do think it's this good.
I also don't enjoy the show that much.
Okay.
So
fair enough.
There's that. The Deuce had so much potential, and it just dragged on and on and on. Maggie Gyllenhaal just burned through the screen. Such a great job.
Mm-hmm.
But I do posit that one James Franco is enough, let alone two.
Right. I didn't really like shows with identical twins this year. The third season of Fargo was my least favorite by far of the three. And why do you need two James Francos playing twins? It's weird. Like, it looks like The Parent Trap. It's so weird.
This show reeked of trying to recreate The Wire.
Mm.
And it's the subject matter is so interesting. There were. This is, listen, I still enjoyed it for the most part. And I will watch season two, but it's being presented in the style of storytelling and cinematography as prestige TV, right? In the way
of... So you don't think it is?
I don't. Because I think it could do so much more with the story and the material.
So Maggie Gyllenhaal has actually done a lot of interviews where she said she only took this role if she could have an active part in the creative process, that she could inform her character's decisions, the way that women are portrayed and filmed, because this is an inherently exploitative product, right? It's about pornography in the 70s. I think it has been successful in some ways and unsuccessful in others. The just the sheer amount of nudity, like female nudity versus male nudity, which is something she talked about, is disproportionate. Definitely. I think it's a fine balance. Like, how do you show exploitation without being exploitative? How do you show violence against women without being triggering, without being exploitative?
And because gratuitous. This
is right. Because this is something that was part and parcel of this life, and they have to show the danger of sex work, but do it in ways that, I don't know, like it's just a hard subject matter.
It's also very slow.
Hmm.
Which, if you're gonna go
and for that, an 8-episode season, that is a problem.
If you're gonna go that route, you have to do it well. Overrated. Top of the Lake was great previously. This last season was pretty awful.
Yeah, I didn't really like this one. You had Girlfriend Experience. Actually, I didn't watch the season. I just wasn't that into it.
I tried.
I missed Riley Coe.
Yeah. I was taken aback because I thought it was going to be the same setup.
Mm.
Instead, we got new characters, new stories. And each Sunday, they'd release two episodes. And each episode would be telling a different arc. And through the first four episodes, I found one more interesting than the other, and then right. I realized I found neither interesting, and so I didn't finish.
Yeah, I can't believe you have Search Party on your overrated. Oh my god, I love Search Party.
It's hard for a show to be overrated when it doesn't have that great big of an audience.
Mm.
But for the folks who love it, they absolutely love it. It absolutely is not my cup of tea. Like, I still watched it, but these characters are. And I get this is the point beyond redeemable. It's like these are some of the right. worst people you've ever seen on TV.
They are. Because it's like a heightened parody of millennial self-centeredness, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Aaliyah Shawkat from Arrested Development, you may know her as Maybe Fionke, puts in a great performance in this. And she sort of descends into total depravity.
Some of the more underrated shows on TV I'll let you lead with the first one because it's one of your favorite shows in history.
Actually, you put Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, and I would not put it here. I actually did not like the season at all. And critics say this is the best season yet. It dives into mental illness in a very serious way. While I appreciate that, I don't think it made for very good viewing.
But it was, you'd still concede that it's a good show.
It is a very good show.
And that it doesn't get as much due as it probably should.
Agreed.
Okay.
But Jane the Virgin is a much better show.
Okay. Queen Sugar doesn't get as much recognition because it's kind of, in a way, buried on OWN. It doesn't have the wide audience that other shows do. But I've thoroughly enjoyed this TV show.
This is one of the best dramas on TV, bar none. There is nothing like it. It's about a black family in rural Louisiana, outside of New Orleans, who have inherited a sugar plantation from their father. And it gets into these issues of class, of pigmentation, of race, of just many centuries of history in this parish in Louisiana.
And Tara from True Blood.
Mm-hmm. Rutina Wesley.
One of the best performances on TV.
She is radiant in every way. She just, like, there's, it's almost like there's something coming off her. There's an energy that jumps through the screen. I can't really describe. She's really something else on the show.
I'm really disappointed that Sense8 was canceled. I loved that show. Mm. There are parts of it that just wasn't that good necessarily, but I didn't care.
Right. It's almost like the story was secondary on Sense8.
Yeah.
Because
it was exciting. It had great representation for all different types of people. Some of the characters were really hot.
Yes.
Lito and Hernando.
I would say there were so many characters and dynamics to work with. The plot almost felt like a drag. Mm-hmm. Like, you could just have vignettes with these characters.
It was ambitious in terms of the multiple locations that they had to shoot at around the world. So that was cost prohibitive in the end, it seems.
But what is cost prohibitive for Netflix?
I don't know.
They have literally never made a profit in how many, 8-9 years of existing?
They also don't, we don't know what their ratings are and how different shows, and would ratings even matter? Say Netflix acknowledges that Sense8 was watched by 90% of their subscribers, but does that show bring in new people?
What does that mean?
Like, we don't know how to assess anything.
There's no advertising revenue, so what does that mean?
Yeah, and so if they're gonna diversify and try and make a whole bunch of new shows, maybe they just have to cut from the top, regardless of how good or liked it is. I don't know.
Right.
Bottom line is, I loved this show. The Good Fight, it's on CBS All Access. Is that what it is?
Something like that.
CBS's new online streaming service. And it's
this, can you imagine paying for CBS's streaming service when there's already Hulu, HBO Go, Netflix, Amazon Prime? Like, come on. Every network will have a streaming service eventually.
It's a spinoff of The Good Wife. We have Diane Lockhart. She's joined a majority black firm. And again, a TV show with great representation for black folks.
I just love The Good Wife so much. And I felt that the character of Alicia had gotten a little dark, for lack of a better word, that I'm glad the universe still exists, but in a different way.
I'll let you take this last one, because I cannot believe that it's on this list.
Floribama Shore is one of my favorite shows of the year. I can't lie. And I really think you should watch it.
I guarantee you I will not.
It's just, it's good TV. It is like, they advertised it as Jersey Shore, but for Trump voters, basically. I didn't even know there was such a thing called Floribama. It's just like the Gulf Coast in northern Florida, basically. What's that place called? Where they do? Yeah, like around there, where they have spring break and stuff.
Daytona?
Daytona, yes. Daytona, I think. Anyway, it brought together just...
How am I giving you knowledge about your American geography?
I don't know. I've never been to northern Florida. Maybe I have to go. like where Jason Mendoza is from on Good Place, Jacksonville.
Yeah.
This show is just so trashy and lovable, and they humanize some characters who I would normally think are just horrible Trump voters.
Okay.
I implore you to watch it. There's a lot of good fights, too.
I think this brings us to the end of the episode. However, I do want to finish up with a couple of shout-outs to some other shows that, while we won't talk about them specifically, are shows that I absolutely recommend you watch. Having watched so many different shows, and especially in the late November to January off-season in TV, I picked up a lot of shows on Netflix that I normally wouldn't have, and they absolutely filled the void, and then some. And so we talked about on a previous tennis episode how much we loved Scam, which was out of Norway. But there are all these other shows from Scandinavia. I just finished Rita from Denmark. Absolutely love this show. So good. If the show is canceled after four seasons, I'll be okay with it, only because the finale was so good. But I really want a season five. Call My Agent, loved it.
That's from France.
Mm-hmm. Bonus Familien, again, so good. You have to have your reading glasses on, because they are subtitles.
Unless you speak Swedish.
Yep, there's that. But if you're looking for shows outside of the box for North American English speakers, then we can absolutely recommend these shows. And the other one I want to plug here is Cable Girls. Thoroughly enjoyed that one.
You may have heard of this show called Smilf, which was nominated for Golden Globes, and nobody had ever heard of it. I had never heard of it. But we gave it a chance, and it was actually very funny. And I liked it a lot. The lead character is totally messy. Connie Britton is on it, playing against type.
Yes.
It's definitely worth a go.
Rosie O'Donnell plays just a messed up mother of the main protagonist, who clearly has suffered from mental illness in her life. But it works. And the last thing I want to throw in here before we leave is I thoroughly enjoyed this last season of The Americans. I know my opinion is in the minority, but
that's surprising to me, because it was generally very slow. It was good, but it felt like some place setting.
Well, that's why I liked it. You know, I do not like the shooting up, the high stakes, the drama, the suspense. Will they, won't they die? I like the storytelling.
Uh-huh.
And with those two characters in particular, Philip and Elizabeth, there's so much that can be done with just them and their story and how great they act, that I was fully on board. I saw a lot of people hated it because it didn't have the suspense this year, and that's exactly why I loved it.
You mean you didn't miss them shoving dead bodies into suitcases? I mean, there's a certain appeal.
If that's your bag.
Thank you for indulging us, letting us talk about our pop culture likes and dislikes for so long.
We'll be back to tennis shortly.
Yeah, there's a lot coming up. Serena's about to play an exhibition, like, in a few minutes. She's back at Indian Wells in her first real WTA event. Venus will be there. Marion Bartoli is staging this comeback. Like,
Vika is back as well in Indian Wells.
We don't know for how long. It may just be for Indian Wells. Sharapova is supposed to play Indian Wells. Like, there is going to be a lot to talk about, so we wanted to slot this episode in right before that.
Mm-hmm. You can find me on Twitter at tennis_John.
And you can find me at ElliotJMR. I'll spell it this time. 2 L's and 2 T's. Because somebody implied that I was lazy for not spelling it.
Oh, is that what that was?
Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I see you. You can find us on Twitter at TheBodySurf and on Instagram at TheBodySurf. And please find us on iTunes. Leave us a review. We thank you again for listening.
Till next time.